June 26, 1943. Over occupied Europe, somewhere west of the Rhine. Second Lieutenant Robert Johnson is in serious trouble. His P-47 Thunderbolt has just absorbed somewhere around 20 rounds from a Focke-Wulf 190 that came out of the sun before Johnson even knew it was there. The cockpit is shot through. Smoke, the hydraulics are gone. His canopy is jammed shut, which means he cannot get out. He is sitting in a burning, shot-up, barely controllable airplane with no way to leave it, somewhere over Germany. The Pratt & Whitney R2800 behind that firewall is still running. Somehow, Johnson aims west, and he flies. Then a Focke-Wulf 190 slides up alongside him. The German pilot pulls in close enough that Johnson can see his face. The man looks at the wrecked Thunderbolt, looks at Johnson. He fires a few more bursts. They hit. Nothing vital dies. The big radial keeps turning. The German pilot shakes his head by some accounts. He's out of ammunition, or he can't believe the thing is still flying, or maybe something else entirely is going through his mind. He breaks off. He turns east. Johnson flies that shattered airplane back to England, lands at a Royal Air Force base at Manston. The ground crew counts over 200 holes in the airframe. The Thunderbolt brought him home. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today, I want to talk about the airplane that did something like that over and over again throughout the Second World War. The Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, the Jug, the biggest, heaviest single-engine fighter anybody put into combat in that war. And the story behind it starts not in Long Island where the airplane was built, but in Tiflis on the south slope of the Caucasus Mountains in the year 1912. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com to understand the Thunderbolt. You have to understand two men, and those two men are about as interesting as any characters you'll find in American aviation history. The first is Alexander D. Seversky, born in Tiflis, Georgia in 1894, which was then part of the Russian Empire. His father was a successful businessman and one of the first private citizens in Russia to own an airplane. Young Alexander grew up around aircraft. He went to the Imperial Russian Naval Academy, learned to fly, and was assigned to naval aviation just in time for the First World War. In 1915, D. Seversky was on a mission in the Baltic when his aircraft was hit. A bomb detonated prematurely. His right leg was gone. He was 21 years old. Most people, that's the end of the story. For D. Seversky, it was an interruption. After months of recovery, he went to the Tsar himself and argued that an experienced combat pilot with one leg was more valuable than a new pilot with two. The Tsar agreed. D. Seversky went back to combat. He ended the war with 13 aerial victories. He came to the United States in 1918, became an American citizen, and spent years working as an aeronautical engineer, test pilot, and tireless advocate for air power. In 1931, he founded Seversky Aircraft Corporation on Long Island, New York. But the man who actually designed the airplanes was Alexander Kardvelli. Kardvelli was also from Georgia, the old Georgia across the Black Sea, not the Peach State. He came to the United States by way of Paris, where he had studied engineering and worked for some of the great French aircraft designers. By the time he arrived at Seversky Aircraft in 1931, he had the kind of aeronautical mind that comes along once in a generation. Kardvelli and De Seversky made an odd pair. De Seversky was the visionary, the salesman, the man who got the contracts. Kardvelli was the engineer who had to turn those ideas into metal that actually flew. When the Army Air Corps put out a requirement in 1940 for a new high-altitude fighter, something that could operate above 30,000 feet and deal with whatever the Luftwaffe was flying, Kardvelli went to his drawing board. What he came up with was audacious.
The heart of the design was the Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp, an 18-cylinder, air-cooled radial arranged in two rows of nine, producing 2,045 horsepower at takeoff. That is an enormous amount of power, and to make that engine perform at altitude where the air is thin, Kardvelli designed a massive turbo supercharger system that ran through the belly of the fuselage. Exhaust from the engine traveled all the way back to a turbine near the tail, which drove the supercharger, which fed compressed air back to the engine up front. It was an engineering challenge of the first order, and the ductwork to make it work occupied the entire rear fuselage. Which meant the airplane was big, very big. By the time you added the airframe, the armor plating, the self-sealing fuel tanks, and 850 caliber Browning machine guns in the wings, the P-47 Thunderbolt weighed somewhere around 9,000 pounds empty. In a combat configuration, loaded and fueled, it could approach 14,000 pounds. Some versions, prepared for ground attack with external fuel and ordnance, went heavier still. For comparison, the Spitfire weighed about 5,500 pounds empty. The pilots called it the Jug. The story goes that seen from behind, with that big round radial and fat fuselage, it looked like a milk jug. The name stuck, and like a jug, it was solid, heavy. not particularly elegant looking. What it was nearly indestructible. The air-cooled radial engine was a big part of why. Unlike a liquid-cooled inline, the radial could lose individual cylinders and keep running. A single rifle caliber round through the coolant system of a liquid-cooled engine could bring it down in minutes. That same round hitting one cylinder of the R2800 might not even change the engine note. Pilots came back, with cylinders shot away, pushrods bent, ignition systems damaged, and the engine still pulling them toward home. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the Thunderbolt size, which worried everyone in the early days, turned out to be a kind of armor in itself. The pilots who came from lighter aircraft had opinions about the cockpit that ranged from impressed to slightly overwhelmed. The Spitfire pilot who transitioned into the Jug talked about it the way someone describes moving from a studio apartment to a house. There was room to move, room to store gear. The instrument panel was comprehensive. The seat was, relatively speaking, comfortable. Gabreski later said that the sheer size of the airplane, which had felt intimidating at first, became reassuring once he understood what it could take. He trusted it the way you trust a solid working dog rather than a thoroughbred. Both have their virtues. You just don't take the working dog to the races. The high-altitude performance was extraordinary for its time. That turbo supercharger system gave the P-47 genuine capability at 30,000 feet and above. The Thunderbolt could operate where the bombers flew, stay with them through the altitude band, where they were most vulnerable, and fight the German interceptors on at least equal terms. And then it would dive. When you see a P-47 in a dive on gun camera footage, even old grainy wartime film, there is something startling about how fast it builds speed. The compressibility effects were real. Pilots occasionally lost control in extreme dives. As the Mach number approached limits, the airplane wasn't quite designed for. Some of them pulled out, some of them didn't, but the pilots who learned to manage the dive, who didn't push into the regime where the controls became unreliable, had a weapon that almost nothing in the Luftwaffe's inventory could catch once it committed downhill. The problem in the early days of the European Air War was range. The 8th Air Force was running bomber missions deep into Germany. The B-17 Flying Fortresses and B-24 Liberators needed fighter escort to survive the Luftwaffe. But the early P-47, operating from England, had a combat radius of maybe 200 miles. That was enough to push the bombers partway into Europe. But when the fighters had to turn back, the bombers were on their own, and the Luftwaffe knew exactly when the escort left. The losses were catastrophic. The second Schweinfurt raid in October of 1943 lost 60 bombers, 600 men, in a single afternoon.
The solution was external fuel. Drop tanks. A ferry tank under the belly. Later improved with larger wing tanks, eventually pushed the combat radius of the P-47 out to 450 miles or better. Still not Berlin from England, but enough to keep the bombers alive significantly longer over the most dangerous part of the route. The pilots who flew the Thunderbolt to its strengths became some of the most effective fighter pilots of the war. Francis Gabreski flew with the 56th Fighter Group, the same group as Robert Johnson. Gabreski ended the European theater with 28 aerial victories. He was the top-scoring American ace against the Luftwaffe. He had grown up in Oil City, Pennsylvania, the son of Polish immigrants, and he flew with an intensity that his squadron mates described as controlled ferocity. The Jug, in his hands, was not a defensive weapon, it was a hunting tool. Robert Johnson, who opened our story today, finished his tour with 27 victories, out in the Pacific, where the P-38 Lightning usually got the headlines. Neil Carby took a Thunderbolt and proved it could fight in that theater too. Carby ended with 22 aerial victories before he was killed in combat in 1944. Flying against odds, he had been warned not to push. He was awarded the Medal of Honor for an engagement in October of 43, where he shot down 6 Japanese aircraft in a single mission. By the second half of the war, the P-47 had settled into a role that would define its legacy as much as the escort mission did. Ground attack. The Thunderbolt could carry rockets, bombs, and incendiaries, and still bring home a pilot after absorbing ground fire that would have destroyed a lighter airplane. The 9th Air Force flew Thunderbolts up and down the roads of France and Germany, hunting trucks, trains, tanks, artillery, fuel depots. Anything that moved, the Germans called them Jabos. The word comes from Jagdbomber, fighter bomber. It carried a particular dread. A tank might survive a near miss from a bomb. It was not going to survive a full rocket salvo from a Thunderbolt coming in low and fast, with 850 caliber stitching the road to mark the way. More than 15,600 P-47s were built before the end of the war. It was among the 2 most produced American fighter aircraft of the entire conflict. The Mustang ended up with more of the glamour, and there were reasons for that. The Mustang had the range to reach Berlin. The Mustang was elegant,
with that laminar flow wing and clean lines. The Thunderbolt was the workhorse. The truck. The thing you called when you needed something destroyed and you needed it done reliably. The men who flew it knew the difference after the war. The Thunderbolt served with air forces around the world. Brazil flew them into the 1950s. The French flew them in Indochina. The aircraft had outlasted the war it was built for and kept working long after. Today there are a handful of flyable P-47s left. Finding one at Oshkosh or at one of the Warbird shows is still possible, though the numbers get smaller every decade. When you hear that R-2800 turn over and fire when all 18 cylinders catch, and that deep rolling roar builds, you understand something about why the men who flew these airplanes felt the way they did about them. There's a weight to it, a presence. The Thunderbolt on the ramp is unmistakably serious machinery. Johnson flew his Thunderbolt home through over 200 holes in June of 43. He went on to score 27 victories before he finished his tour. He survived the war and flew for decades as a civilian. Cardvale spent the rest of his career at Republic Aviation, designing not just the Thunderbolt but later the F-84 Thunderjet and eventually the F-105 Thunderchief, carrying American air power into the jet age. Dzhokhovskiy continued to write and advocate for air power until late in his life. Both men died in 1974, within months of each other. Two men from Georgia, the old Georgia, who came to America and gave it one of the most effective combat aircraft of the Second World War. Sources today include Robert Johnson's memoir, Thunderbolt, Francis Gabreski's account, Gabby, A Fighter Pilot's Life, and Roger Freeman's History of the 8th Air Force. More at radiohangar.com. Taildragger out.